Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tverkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente interkulturell.
Absolutely intercultural.
A very warm welcome to show number 30 of Absolutely Intercultural. My name's Anne Fox, and this show is coming to you from Denmark. Lined up for you today is another dispatch from the Does Culture Matter conference in Washington, a report about what it's like to work in Japan from an Indian perspective. And finally, I had to send my special correspondent all the way to Iceland to catch up with a British civil servant who has found his intercultural training invaluable in his international career. In the last show, we heard about how to improve your English by using song lyrics. I have another suggestion, and that is that you go to our blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com and get into conversation with us by adding a comment about this or any other of our shows. We'll begin with a conversation I had with Yogesh Bang, a software engineer based in India, and his experiences of going on assignment in Japan. So let's go absolutely national.
My name is Yogesh Bang. I work in India as a software engineer.
And one of the places that you've been to quite often, I think, is to Japan. Is that right?
Yes, I have been to Japan 9 times.
And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what it was like to work in Japan compared to when you're working at home in India.
It's definitely different than the Indian work culture and the Western work culture as well. The first thing which I observed in Japanese work culture is the belongingness of the employees towards the company which they work for. So the employee definitely feels belonging to the company, and they are ready to devote a lot for those companies.
So you're saying that the employees feel a little bit as though the company is like their family?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you can feel those sense of belongingness while interacting with them, while when they are making any decisions. They are always towards the company, taking the big picture into account. The second peculiarity which I observed about Japanese work culture is the consensus decision making. While taking any decisions, the Japanese prefer to discuss those decisions among themselves. So the decision making process becomes very slow. But since the decisions are always taken with consensus, it's believed to be in favor of those people who are going to work on those particular work packs. So, I mean, it's time-consuming. But again, it's taken by considering big picture. So it's guaranteed that the decision will definitely help those organizations.
So do you adapt when you go over to Japan, or do you try and work in the Indian way?
We usually work as vendor for the Japanese companies. So we do not necessarily participate in decision-making process as such, but this is what I have observed as a third person in a Japanese organization. The Japanese companies are strict to hierarchies. They adhere to the hierarchies. So a person, when he joins a company, he joins at an operational level and then gradually makes his progress towards the tactical and then the strategic level. Most of the times, the decisions of the promotions are based on the experience and the age, which in a way is helpful for that company because the person stays with that company for that long and has the total picture of that company. Mm.
So when you go to Japan as a visitor, how do you fit into that hierarchy?
Most of the times we do happen to interact with the people at the strategic and tactical levels, but at times our dealing is mostly with at the operational level. But we do understand that the decision making need to happen at the tactical and the strategic level. So if there are any important decisions which need to be taken, let's say regarding the hardware purchase or while buying a new software or deciding on about the budget and all, we do understand that it's going to take some time. So we do adapt to these kind of things when we work in Japan.
Doesn't the deference to hierarchy conflict a little bit with the consensus decision making?
That's definitely true. Yeah, usually the person up in hierarchy, his decisions counts more weightage than the person who is falling down the hierarchy. So definitely that strict adherence to hierarchy is definitely there.
So when you are in Japan, are you comfortable with the way in which they work?
I like the way the way they devote to the work. For example, I would like to quote that whatever they expect, the product that you deliver to Japanese, that should be defect-free. And with every delivery of that particular product, expect continuous improvement in that product and less number of defects in that product. So the bar is always rising. And the person who is into the vendor shoes for the Japanese companies always on their toes. As I said, there are a good side of Japanese work culture, there are a dark side of Japanese work culture as well. As an Indian or someone from the Western country may find that the prolonged working hours are a little difficult to be adjusted with.
Oh, that's interesting, because when you went to Britain, you thought that the working hours were very short. So what's a reasonable working day for you?
For me, as an Indian, the reasonable working day starts from 9 and ends at 6 o'clock. But again, that concept is no more in India as well, since India is also progressing a lot. So people are expected to stay back and work for prolonged hours. So I can say even in India, people work for 10 to 12 hours a day.
But even longer in Japan, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct. Even it's longer in Japan, maybe to 14 to 16 hours a day.
Oh, my goodness. So is there time to sleep?
Yeah, actually you always compromise on your sleep when you are working for the Japanese companies.
Okay, so you said that you would have some advice for people going to Japan, and maybe is that one piece of advice, not to expect to sleep too much?
That would be correct. So I would say that you should, the person who is visiting as a vendor in Japan should be physically fit and should be ready to compromise on the sleep.
Okay. Yes, of course. It makes sense, but I've never seen it written down before. It makes sense, yeah.
One more dark side of the work culture in Japan is not many women employees make it to the top. So you won't find many women working at the strategic or tactical or more of a senior level. Most of the times the women employee work till she get married, and after that they prefer to be housewife or take some other job which would give them work-life balance. And one very funny thing which I observed in a meeting in Japan is the woman employee who is a part of the meeting is supposed to serve the tea and coffee in the meeting.
So it's not like that in India?
It's not like that in India. I think we have men and women equality at the workplace itself.
We'll be returning to the issue of consensus decision-making at the end of the show. Next, we'll go absolutely educational and hear more from the Does Culture Matter conference, where Chris Sanger in Washington listened in on a controversial explanation for cultural differences.
We had a scholar named Lawrence Harrison, who's very, very much, very, very important in the field, I think, of intercultural relations, but also very, very controversial. He's not afraid to sort of go head to head with the more liberal kind of mainstream, especially here at a university where people, I think, tend to live up to the stereotype of the academy being a little bit more liberal. And his thesis in a nutshell is that there are some cultures that are more prone to social and economic development than others. And he provides some information. One of the comparisons he made in his talk was between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which share the same island in the Caribbean. And Haiti's cultural heritage is from West Africa, and voodoo is the dominant religion, whereas the Dominican Republic is more European. The Spaniards colonized that part of the island, and there's been a dramatic divergence in the way that those two countries have developed, and he traces that back to culture. And it doesn't sit real well with some of the people in the field, but I give him a lot of credit for taking his ideas and his evidence, and he does have his evidence and his arguments and presenting those. So that was one really important part of the conference too, that we don't just try to bring people who share our point of view and preach to the choir, as we say in the USA, but that we really try to engage with the people who are important in the field and who may not have the point of view that we agree with.
I do agree that it is good to hear different viewpoints to force us to think more deeply about our own beliefs. What do you think? Intercultural competence training is an issue which we keep revisiting, and those of you who've been with us from the early days may recall the interesting discussions on the Hofstede model, mapping cultural behaviours. This can be used in training, and we tracked down David Stroud, a senior civil servant in the UK, who underwent such training to help him in his many international meetings. For this, I had to send my special correspondent, Tony Fox, all the way to Iceland to track David down. So let's go absolutely educational once more.
Okay, well, what was your intercultural training course like?
Well, it was a three-day course run by the Civil Service Training College, which was, well, really introduced me to the Hofstede model, which I found absolutely fascinating. Yeah, so the Hofstede model, I mean, essentially, I find is very intuitive, and I've used it a lot in sort of the work I do internationally, particularly with sort of other government delegations in international negotiating contexts.
So it has been useful.
No, it was immediately useful, and as I said, I think it allows you to sort of see where people are coming from, and to an extent, actually, to sort of predict likely behaviours on the basis of cultural characteristics.
But is this not something that you know intuitively anyway, or are you not just trading on cultural stereotypes, for instance?
I think it's more than stereotyping. I mean, I think it provides a sort of reality. And it was quite interesting that one of the girls on the course, we filled in questionnaires which allowed us to essentially sort of score ourselves against the various traits. And she came out very differently from most of the other participants, and was actually had very French characteristics. And she said that she'd always felt sort of culturally, although she was British, she'd always felt culturally much more at home in France than in Britain, even though she was British born and bred, which was quite interesting, I think.
But you actually find yourself using this resource. It hasn't been a complete waste of time.
No, indeed, and I think particularly, well, obviously in the formal sense of working with other people in well, I guess in business contexts or in negotiation contexts, but I mean, I think just generally, I think it gives you an insight into how individuals from different countries, different cultures approach similar situations really quite differently.
Do you actually experience enough difference? I mean, is there sufficient difference in Europe for this sort of framework to help in your everyday dealings in international circles?
Well, indeed. I mean, one of the fascinating things for me was the fact that the range of variation of the Hofstede scores within Europe is more than in any other part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually within Europe, within geographical Europe, you have a as big a variation of cultural identity than you do in any other part of the world, which perhaps is why the European project is sometimes so difficult.
Mm. Mm.
But one of the particular aspects I was fascinated in is the sort of confusion dynamism score, which particularly comes out, it's not so relevant in most of the world, but particularly comes out in the far, far east, and is concerned with things like saving face, the importance of face and respect for others. And that's quite interesting in the context of international meetings, because there's a big reluctance, I think, from a lot of the Far Eastern cultures to stand up in public and tell somebody they've got it completely wrong, or sort of fundamentally object to a negotiating position that's been taken. I mean, all of that sort of stuff happens outside of the meeting, in the margins, in the evenings, but not actually within a formal negotiating context, which I think provides some degree of cultural disadvantage to those countries. You know, when you're in a big setup, this sort of business of respecting others, providing almost a sort of break on the types of behaviour that one might adopt in a negotiating situation.
Mm. The course was obviously both cultural general and cultural specific. Did you get enough access to tools from the specific to really help to deal with a Frenchman or, you know, at that level?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the Institute for Training in Intercultural Management produce a range of sort of resource materials, which, well, I've got them now, sort of a rather battered scorecards and summary material, which travel with me everywhere in the back of my diary, and quite often I whip these out and have a quick quick refresh on where we're going. But there's no doubt, I'm sure there's probably other resource material on the web, but I use this not infrequently still.
Okay. Great, David Stroud. Thank you very much indeed.
There can be no better evidence of effective training than that image of David carrying his Hofstadter scorecards round the world with him. And did you notice how the high score for saving face in Far Eastern countries ties in with the consensus decision-making observed by Yogesh Bang in our first feature? Thank you to our volunteers for today, and if you have an interesting story to tell, then why not get in touch? We prefer it if you leave a comment on our blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com, or you could send us an audio comment to the email address contact@absolutely-intercultural.com. Whatever your interest, the next show will be coming out on May the 18th from Germany. So, stay tuned.
Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturalisch.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.